Our speaker this evening is Terry B. Ball, professor of ancient scripture at BYU. Currently, he is serving as dean of religious education. His bachelor of science degree is in botany. His master's degree was in ancient Near Eastern studies. You can see how what an integrated man he is. And his PhD is in botany. Most people do not know that Dean Ball is an internationally known expert on phytoliths. And all of you who are really into phytoliths will recognize the name immediately. The fact that some of us don't know what phytoliths are is simply a token of how much he really knows, I guess. I think it's very interesting that the Dean of Religious Education is a botanist. That's wonderful. Where in the world can you go to get a graduate degree in teaching LDS religion? It doesn't exist. And therefore, we have a lot of people on the religious faculty here at BYU who have degrees in many different fields, and we need all of them. We love them all. Brother Ball will speak on Nibley and the environment. In conjunction with that, I wanted to give you two little quotes from Brother Nibley. Every way of life produces its own environment, and in turn is influenced by that environment. It is possible for a powerful mind to have joy amidst vile surroundings. I wonder if he was talking about himself there and his World War II experiences. When you read the book, you get that feeling. But it can have even greater joy in pleasant surroundings. The story of the Garden of Eden teaches us that environment is important. Brother Ball.
Well, I'm delighted and honored to be able to participate in this lecture series, remembering the life and legacy and studies of Professor Hugh Nibley. I need to make a sad confession to begin with. I did not have the opportunity of personally knowing Professor Nibley. He retired from BYU before I joined the faculty. But, like many academics on this campus, I happen to have a couple of Hugh Nibley stories. And which, in contrast to some that I've heard, I know to be true. Story one. When I was working on my master's degree, I did a study on the ritual theory of myth and its application in the ancient Near East. That's a topic about which Nibley had much to say. And in a subsequent paper I wrote reporting my study, I quoted from Nibley quite often. After I'd written the paper, I submitted a draft to Gary Gillam, Nibley's esteemed bibliographer, to review it for me. To this day, I'm not sure if one of the sentences in that particular draft contained a typo or a Freudian slip. In that particular sentence, I meant to write, "According to Hugh Nibley," but somehow I had managed to switch the U in Hugh for an I. And so the sentence read, "According to High Nibley." I'm not sure what Gary thought when he read that. He must have wondered what I was thinking. Maybe he thought that I was trying to bestow some new reverential or honorific title upon him, "According to High Nibley." Or perhaps, heaven forbid, he thought I was thinking Nibley was medicated or under the influence when he made the comment I was referencing, "According to High Nibley." Or maybe he thought I was introducing a new scholarly language akin to High Dutch or High German, High Nibley. Whatever it was he assumed I was thinking, he must have thought it was tenable, because rather than suggesting a correction, he just simply wrote in the margin of the draft, "Perhaps." Story two. While I was working on my PhD here, Geza Vermesh, the renowned Dead Sea Scrolls scholar, came to give a lecture here at BYU, which was a wonderful event. I didn't want to miss it, so I arrived early at the lecture hall, and I saw that Professor Nibley was sitting on the front row, and I thought, here is my chance to actually get close to the legend. But not wanting to be too presumptuous, I came in and slipped in a seat in the row immediately behind him. Shortly afterwards, Dr. Vermesh arrived, and as he worked his way towards the front of the lecture hall, he saw Professor Nibley and recognized him and stopped to talk to him. I enjoyed eavesdropping on their conversation. I suspected that their relationship was a fraternal and somewhat comfortable one, because as they were exchanging pleasantries, Nibley fixed his eyes on Gezer Vermesh's obviously balding white head, and likely thinking of his own, said in Hebrew, "Yesheleg al Her Harim." There is snow on the mountains. I suspect that for these two elderly academics, there was something of both humor and pathos meant in what he had to say. Now, while I didn't get to know Professor Nibley personally, I feel that I have come to know him some through his writings. It's one of the great beauties of scholarship and writing, is that you leave a legacy, and he's left a marvelous one for us. Tonight I've been asked to talk about his thoughts on a very controversial issue, the environment. Nibley was passionate about our stewardship in regards to environment and about caring for nature and creation. He, in this battle, didn't seem to think that truth needed tact, just expression. And he expressed himself well. There is a popular folktale that says that rather than give in to legal and political and neighborhood pressure to keep his lawn mowed, Nibley simply bought a goat and staked it out in his front yard to keep the grass eaten down. His son-in-law and biographer says, while that story is not true, it does accurately reflect Nibley's aversion to cutting down any or trimming any living thing, an aversion that Brother Peterson suggests likely grew out of his experiences as a young boy in the lush forest lands of Oregon, witnessing their destruction at the hands of his own grandfather. As we might expect, Nibley's feelings about the environment were not so much informed by science, but rather by the disciplines he knew and loved better, by philosophy and history and theology. He was especially fond of and resonated with Brigham Young's teachings on the topic. And from the prophet's teachings and from those beloved disciplines, he formulated a few principles that seem to have dictated his thoughts and feelings about the environment. Tonight, what I'd like to do is review four of those principles with you from his own writings. So, principle number one, humankind has a divine mandate to properly care for creation. In a piece first printed in the October 1972 New Era entitled Man's Dominion, Nibley tackled the question of what exactly did God mean in Genesis 1:28 when he gave the commandment to Adam and Eve to subdue and have dominion over the earth. He explained that in Hebrew the terms kivshu and rodu, translated respectively as subdue and have dominion in the KJV, both have the basic root meaning of exerting pressure, that being, however, merely a point of departure for a whole spectrum of derivatives. He noted that according to individual taste and temperament, translators of the term have variously interpreted it to mean everything from to plow, to violate, or to cherish. Nibley felt it a clue to the true intent of the commandment to kivshu and rodu, to subdue and have dominion, could be found in the book of Moses. In the 5th chapter, in the 1st verse, we read, "And it came to pass that after I, the Lord God, had driven them out, that Adam began to till the earth and to have dominion over all the beasts of the field and to eat his bread by the sweat of his brow." Nibley observed that in this passage the word till substitutes or replaces the word subdue and applies specifically to the earth, while the word dominion applies to animals. He then noted that after God commanded the animals to multiply and have joy, he gave the same commandment to Adam and Eve and made him, Adam, Lord over the whole earth and gave him dominion over it. Accordingly, he reasoned, lordship and dominion are the same thing. Drawing then upon the original meanings of the word lordship and dominion, he further pointed out that one who is a lord is one who is a lord over a household, or one who has the responsibility to be a benefactor and care for those under his domain. Thus, Nibley summarized, man is not to be a predator, a manipulator, or an exploiter of other creatures, but one who cooperates with nature as a diligent husbandman. Nibley observed that the ancients equated this dominion or lordship with the priesthood, the power to act for God and in his name. Brigham Young taught that The Spirit of the Lord and the keys of the priesthood hold power over all animated beings. Thus, man is to be in charge of the things God created and see that they are preserved and cared for on behalf of God himself. As God's appointed caretakers of creation, Nibley felt we should labor to improve our environment. He appreciated Brigham Young's counsel on how the saints were to care for the earth. The prophet instructed, "There's a great work for the saints to do. Progress and improve upon and make beautiful everything around you. Cultivate the earth and cultivate your mind. Build cities. Adorn your habitations. Make gardens and orchards and vineyards and render the earth so pleasant that when you look upon your labors you may do so with pleasure and that angels may delight to come and visit your beautiful locations." Waxing poetically, to summarize what Brigham said, Nibley added, "For Brigham, improvement meant to build in strength and stability, to beautify, to adorn, to embellish, to delight, and to cast a fragrance over the house of the Lord with sweet instruments of music and melody." Specifically, Nibley felt the one way man can leave his mark on the whole face of the earth without damage is to plant. And President Young ceaselessly counseled his people to do, just as Adam had done when he commanded him to dress and tend the garden. The prophet said, "Our work is to beautify the whole face of the earth until it shall become like the Garden of Eden." He continued, "The very object of our existence here is to handle the temporal elements of this world and subdue the earth, multiplying those organisms of plants and animals God has designed shall dwell upon it." Nibley felt Brigham Young gave the wisest summary of what man's dominion of the earth really means when he said, "Let me love the world as God loves it, to make it beautiful and glorify the name of my Father in heaven. It doesn't matter whether I or anyone else owns it. If we only work to beautify it and make it glorious, it is all right." And so Nibley concluded, "Humankind has a divine mandate to care for creation." Principle number two, spiritual health and environmental health are related. On February 16th of 1989, Nibley delivered a speech titled "Stewardship of the Air" at a clean air symposium that was held right here on the BYU campus. He opened the speech by commenting on the miasmic exhalations of Geneva still that he had been obliged to breathe over the past 40 years. He then observed that we learn even from the word of wisdom, body and mind, the temporal and the spiritual, are inseparable, and to corrupt one is to corrupt the other. Inevitably, our surroundings become a faithful reflection of our mentality and vice versa. The right people, according to Brigham Young, could convert hell to heaven and the wrong ones heaven to hell. Every faculty bestowed upon man is subject to contamination, subject to be diverted from the purpose the Creator designed it to fill. And so Nibley continued, "This principle meets us in the Law of Moses. In Numbers 35, we read, 'Ye shall not pollute the land wherein ye are, for blood, it defileth the land. Defile not, therefore, the land which ye shall inhabit, wherein I dwell, for I, the Lord, dwell among the children of Israel.'" And then, drawing from the Doctrine and Covenants, Nibley added, "Today we are told that the whole world lieth in sin, and groaneth under darkness, and under the bondage of sin. For shall the children of the kingdom pollute my holy land? I have promised their restoration to the land of Zion. Nevertheless, if they pollute their inheritances, they shall be thrown down, for I will not spare them if they pollute their inheritances." Like Brigham Young, Nibley seemed to feel that wickedness could pollute the land just as much as industry. As the first saints settled in the Great Basin, Brigham Young admonished them, "You are here commencing anew. The soil, the air, the water are all pure and healthy. Do not suffer them to become polluted with wickedness. Strive to preserve the elements from being contaminated by the filthy, wicked conduct and sayings of those who pervert the intelligence of God has bestowed upon the human family." Nibley resonated with them, with the prophet's instructions, when he said, "Keep your valley pure, keep your towns as pure as you possibly can, keep your hearts pure, and labor what you can consistently, but not so as to injure yourselves. Be faithful in your religion. Be full of love and kindness towards each other." Nibley felt that there was nothing mysterious or abstruse in identifying the defilement of man with the defilement of nature. He found an endorsement for the doctrine in a bicentennial address that was delivered by President Spencer W. Kimball. President Kimball said, "When I review the performance of this people in comparison with what is expected, I am appalled and frightened. Iniquity seems to abound. The destroyer seems to be taking full advantage of the time remaining to him in this, the great day of his power. I have the feeling that the good earth can hardly bear our presence upon it. The brethren constantly cry out against that which is intolerable in the sight of the Lord, against pollution of mind, body, and our surroundings." Indeed, Nibley felt that spiritual health was to be found in nature. Drawing upon the teachings of Brigham Young, he observed, "At a time when free as air signified that a thing was of negligible worth, Brigham Young was insisting that the greatest physical asset the saints possessed, and one they should treasure most highly, was pure air. The prophet said, 'What constitutes health, wealth, joy, and peace? In the first place, good pure air is the greatest sustainer of animal life. The Lord blesses the land, the air, and the water where the saints are permitted to live.'" The ability to appreciate the beauties and wonders of nature is a spiritual gift, Nibley seemed to feel. He agreed with Brigham Young's teachings when he said, "When the spirit of revelation from God inspires a man, his mind is open to behold the beauty, order, and glory of the creation of this earth." That gift, that ability to appreciate nature and loathe its destruction, has been essential to survival, Nibley felt. Without being able to tell exactly why, he said, "We take immediate offense at such statements made by men in high positions, such as, 'I do not believe in conservation for conservation's sake,' or 'I do not believe in clean water for clean water's sake.' But we soon learn that our first shocked reaction is a healthy one, for when the forest is reduced to the now proverbial one redwood, it's too late." The voice of revelation has told the saints where to put their priorities, Nibley declared. "And out of the ground made I, the Lord God, to grow every tree, naturally, that is pleasant to the sight of man, and man could behold it. Trees were made in the first instance to be looked at and enjoyed." Nibley continued, "We are aware of that before research and experience show our intuition to be quite sound. But the feeling for beauty must come first if we are to survive." Interesting statement, huh? Our feeling for beauty must come first if we are to survive. "We should love the earth," says Brigham. "We should love the works which God has made. This is correct, but we should love them in the Lord. We should look forward to a time when this earth will be given to the saints, when they and it are sanctified and glorified." And so Nibley concludes, spiritual health and environmental health are linked. Now, principle 3. This is a really interesting one that I had never considered before reading Nibley. The principle is that creation obeys and reverences and provides for man only as man righteously cares for creation. Nibley mingled the teachings of Latter-day prophets with ideas and traditions from Jewish, Midrashic, mystical, pseudepigraphic, and apocryphal texts to teach that as God's appointed steward over creation, man enjoys the reverence and cooperation of nature only as he righteously and lovingly rules over and cares for it. He quoted from the Zohar, the foundational work of Jewish mystical thought known as the Kabbalah, which teaches that, "Even the fierce beasts of prey fear man as long as he keeps his covenant, his kingly dignity and his eye fixed on God in whose image he is." The Zohar continues, "God formed man in his own heavenly form and made him to be lord over them. Whenever man stands upright and lifts his eyes towards heaven, then all the animals raise their heads too and look to man, fearing and trembling in his presence." Nibley found in other ancient Jewish literature traditions that Adam and Noah and Abraham each had exceptionally nurturing and loving relationships with other creatures of the earth, and they were blessed for it and by it. However, if a man fails in his duty to care for creation, disaster follows. The 2nd century B.C. writings of Ben Sirach teach that the rule over the world is in the hand of God, and at the right time he sets over it one that is worthy. But, Nibley added, if that rule is ever exercised in an arbitrary or arrogant manner, it is quickly taken away and given to someone else. Furthermore, Nibley pointed out, the pseudepigraphic Book of Adam and Eve warns Adam, "If you fail in your duty, the beast over which you rule shall rise up against you, for you have not kept my commandment." And, Nibley added, all creatures are quick to recognize the hand of the oppressor and impostor. According to what Nibley describes as one of the best known teachings of the Jews, when man falls away from God, all nature becomes his enemy. Nibley saw in these ancient texts an endorsement for what he recognized as a favorite theme of Brigham Young, which he summarized by saying, "The dominion God gives man is designed to test him, to enable him to show to himself, his fellow, and all the heavens just how he would act if entrusted with God's own power. If he does not act in a godlike manner, he will never be entrusted with a creation of his own. All the rest of God's creations will surely abide by God's commandments and progress to exaltation," Nibley felt, "but man will only join them in paradise and happiness by doing the same." He saw in this doctrine an admonition to proceed with reverence and care, and scolded that it's only because the Latter-day Saints are ignorant of these things that God has not already cursed them for their brutal and callous treatment of God's other creatures. He further reminded us that while Aristotle and the doctors of Alexandria and normative Judaism and Christianity reject the notion that animals have any rights or ability to reason or to speak, the Latter-day Saints have divine knowledge that each creature God created has a spirit, was created spiritually before receiving a body, and, as President Joseph F. Smith taught, has an equal right to live. Nibley summarized, "Granted, there are different levels and degrees that exist within us, as well as between species. Still, it is the privilege of every form of life to multiply in its sphere and element and have joy therein. Adam's dominion was a charge to see that it all went well with God's creatures. It was not a license to exterminate them." He saw the irreverent treatment of creation as a rejection of the gospel and reminded all that Brigham Young warned, where people refuse the gospel, that land will eventually become desolate, forlorn, and forsaken, for nature will refuse her bounties. Having made himself allergic to most everything by the fall, Nibley explained, man is given the choice of changing his nature so that animal and vegetable creation will cease to afflict and torment him, or of waging a truceless war of extermination against all that annoys him until he renders the earth completely uninhabitable. But Nibley believed that as we righteously and gently use the earth and its resources, it will provide for us. He reminded us that the products of the earth are to please the eye and to gladden the heart, as the Doctrine and Covenant says, yea, for food and for raiment, for taste and for smell, to be used with judgment, not to excess, and neither by extortion. So we may neither waste nor exploit what we have found around us. Nibley pointed out that the Webster Dictionary defines extortion as obtaining from an unwilling or reluctant person by physical force, intimidation, or the abuse of legal or legal authority, legal or official authority. He went on to say, we have a right to take what we need, but when we would extend that right to justify taking things we do not need, that is extortion and is expressly forbidden. It is our privilege and our duty, says Brigham Young, to search all things upon the face of the earth and learn what there is for man to enjoy, what God has ordained for the benefit and happiness of mankind, and then make use of it without sinning against him. It is not our privilege to waste the Lord's substance. That understanding appears to have led Nibley to be a promoter of recycling. He wrote, all waste on this earth becomes garbage. Waste is, in fact, the proper English word for garbage. To throw anything on the trash heap is to cast it aside in contempt. What do we know about its true worth? Who are we to despise what we do not understand? Nibley reminded us of Brigham's counsel, never let anything go to waste. Be prudent. Save everything. Both of them would have been so proud if they could have seen into my garage. He went on to say, even sewage has its uses. Everything also which will fertilize our gardens and our fields should be sedulously saved and wisely husbanded, that nothing may be lost which contains the elements of food and raiment for man and sustenance for beast. And so Nibley concludes, creation obeys reverence, obeys reverences and provides for man, as man righteously cares for creation. And then the fourth principle, and perhaps the one that Nibley was the most passionate about, we should never sacrifice environmental health on the altar of temporal wealth. Nibley was deeply troubled by some Latter-day Saints' refusal to recognize the sanctity of life. To illustrate his distress, he recounts the following experience. One morning, just a week after we had moved into our house on 7th North, as I was leaving for work, I found a group of shouting, arm-waving boys gathered around the big fir tree in the front yard. They had sticks and stones, and in a state of high excitement were fiercely attacking the lowest branches of the trees, which hung to the ground. "Why?" I asked. "There's a quail in the tree," they said, in breathless zeal. "A quail!" "Of course," I said. "What's wrong with that?" "But don't you see? It's a live quail, a wild one." So they just had to kill it. They were on their way to the old Brigham Young High School and were Boy Scouts. Does this story surprise you? What surprises me was when I later went to Chicago and saw squirrels running around the city parks in broad daylight. They wouldn't last a day in Provo. He blamed the boys' malicious actions on the teachings of their leaders, even some in the church, lamenting that, like Verrill's patrician friends, we have taught our children by precept and example that every living thing exists to be converted into cash, and that whatever would not yield a return should be quickly exterminated to make way for creatures that do. He called this vicious doctrine the Mahan principle, referring to the great secret that Satan revealed to Cain, that one may kill to enrich oneself. In his mind, the killing included not only the taking of life, but also the destruction of nature. Nibley understood the Mahan principle taught by Satan to be directly opposed to what God intended when he gave man dominion over the earth. Mahan's doctrine is a wicked counterfeit for true and righteous dominion. Master Mahan's exercised dominion over the earth by exploiting it for wealth and power, with no regard for the sanctity of life or the welfare and health of the environment. While Adamic stewards exercised dominion by nurturing, protecting, and reverencing creation. Nibley explained that God and Satan both presented plans of dominion to Adam and then to his son Cain. The father, Adam, chose one plan, the son Cain, the other. According to early Jewish literature, Noah and Abraham were likewise offered the same choice between these two types of dominion. And, Nibley observed, as was Moses when Satan tempted him, "If thou wilt worship me, all shall be thine." He saw Pluto of Hades, the underworld god of wealth, as another ancient example of a master Mahan. He explained, "All the riches of gems and precious metals hidden beneath the earth are his, but he owns no property above the ground. So," Nibley summarizes, "he brutally kidnaps the fair Proserpine, who represents all the beauty and harmony of nature, to establish his claim over the earth." He then graphically described the abduction. Pluto, in his black quadriga, or black stretched limousine, sweeps out of his subterranean realm amidst choking clouds of sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, and assorted particles, and snatches Proserpine away from the scene to go down and live with him as a very rich but unhappy bride. With her departure, all the upper world becomes as dull and gloomy as Pluto's own busy factories, foundries, and smelters. This makes Pluto's claim to rule over the earth complete. He takes the treasures of the earth and with them creates the wealth and the armaments that enable him to rule through the ages with blood and horror. Nibley observed that in the earliest mythology, Pluto was actually an agrarian figure, but with advancing society, he was transformed into a greedy villain. Much like Cain, who too began as a farmer, and then turned to murder and plunder. He saw both as types for the destroyer, the prince of darkness, who was most often and most widely described as the lord of the underworld, who sits in his Stygian realm upon all the mineral treasures of the earth, worked by toiling slaves amidst foul and pestilential vapors. He continued, "Our lord of the underworld rules under many names, Satan, Loki, Mammon, Mulciber, Hephaestus, etc. And his workers are the gnomes and trolls and kobolds, the dwarfs, and the other grimy, hard-working creatures." He saw this characterization of mines, miners, and its effects on the environment as plainly taken from prehistoric mining regions, such as the immensely old Varna works in Yugoslavia and others in Asia Minor and Cyprus, and from Spain, with its blighted regions of mines, smelters, and foundries, all worked by starving, filthy, driven slaves, converting the landscape into barren wastes of slag and stunted vegetation. Not surprisingly, Nibley's review of the historical and mythical characterization of mine workers as oppressed gnomes, trolls, and kobolds and dwarfs earned him the ire of Utah County residents whose livelihood depended upon Geneva Steel. Some were deeply offended, feeling he was putting them in the same class. It created enough of an uproar, public outcry, that Nibley felt compelled to write a letter to the editor of the local newspaper clarifying his comments. I found the letter to be very telling. It begins, "Dear editor, people often say that they do not understand me. They say it so often that I should have the sense to shut up in public. And now I've gone and done it again. Since it's a preacher's duty to make himself understood, when he fails, he owes his hearers an apology. And I fail every time I step into the past, where I prefer to spend my days. There my students lose me. The past simply does not exist for us today, except in old costume movies revived on TV. So the idea of an age-old confrontation between agriculture and industry in days long past rings no bells. For example, nothing is more beyond dispute than that people who worked in mines and mills have throughout history been underpaid and overworked, living in unspeakably dismal conditions. Most of them, right down to modern times, have in fact been slaves. I've written feelingly about them. But to interpret the above statement as a description of the workers at Geneva, where friends and relatives of mine have worked from the beginning at far better wages than I have ever received, is about as far as misunderstanding can go. And to say that it depicts them as hideous and deformed dwarves forging the fatal Rheingold either makes me the world's worst communicator or denotes a hair-trigger predisposition to jump at conclusions." He closed the letter rather interestingly. He said, "Time did not allow me to give the conclusion to the talk." This is a talk that he gave at the Clean Air Symposium in 89. He says, time did not allow me to give the conclusion of the talk, which was to declare that I no longer worry much about Geneva, that the only time it really got to me was on those sweet spring nights when every breath from the west reminded me of what I was missing. Unfortunately, breathing was not optional, or I could have escaped that prejudice too. Today I see in Geneva a smoking fumarole at the base of a mighty volcano which is just about to blow. I take small comfort in the conviction that before long circumstances are going to settle this problem for us. Sincerely, Hugh Nibley." Nibley's closing conviction proved to be prophetic. The mill stumbled along for another decade and then went bankrupt in 1999, closing forever in November of 2002. Nibley felt that few in the history of the world have been able to resist Satan's Mahan bargain, which often moves one to disregard the life and welfare of the environment in the pursuit of wealth. The first to accept was Cain, who loved Satan more than God. The great secret of success that Cain learned from his new teacher, Satan, was that he could get anything in this world by calculated use of force, with no need to be ashamed, since it could all be done in the sacred name of freedom. Instead of being appalled at the blood on his hands, Cain gloried in that which he had done, saying, "I am free. Surely the flocks of my brother falleth into my hands." Nibley noted that in other ancient Jewish literature, Noah's son Ham bought into Satan's version of the oppressive dominion, followed by Nimrod. Both exploited creatures and creation for their own gain. "All this fits Satan's design well," Nibley said, "for he is spitefully determined to destroy everything that God has commanded to live." In Nibley's view, modern-day Mahans abound. In an address given in 1992 at the J. Reuben Clark Law School at BYU, he condemned the United States government, big oil and mining companies, and attorneys, including Ernest L. Wilkinson, who he considered to be a dear friend, for applying the Mahan principle to wrest mineral and oil-rich lands from the Native Americans, breaking contracts, violating treaties, sacrificing integrity, and destroying the environment in the process. Some of you know that Nibley had a great admiration for Native Americans, especially the Hopis, who he loved to frequently visit. He loved their simple lives, free from the plague of materialism. He honored them for clinging to ancient lifestyles and rejecting eco-damaging industry and technology. He praised them for their tenacity in preserving ancient customs, rites, traditions, and religions. He extolled their culture, which, in his view, was completely religious and therefore completely consistent. In contrast, he mocked and upbraided the insensitive, money-groping modern bureaucrats, politicians, industrialists, attorneys, and businessmen whose wealth-driven myopia prevented them from seeing the beauty and significance of these ancient people and their lands. With disgust, he derided them for deceitfully exploiting Native Americans and their lands in their pursuit of wealth. I wonder how that went over in a room full of contract attorneys. Nibley suggested at one time a taxonomy that should be used to inform our pursuits and our environmental decisions in this life. Borrowing first from Aristotle, he observed that there are two kinds of goods which we are after in this life: goods of first intent and goods of second intent. Goods of second intent are good because they help us obtain other things. Thus, a pencil, a watch, shoes, a hammer, a stove, etc., are all useful for obtaining something beyond their own value. They're goods of second intent. Goods of the first intent, on the other hand, are good in themselves and need no excuse. They're not the means, but the goal. Thus, millions of people take the plane to Hawaii. The plane is a good of second intent, if it gets us there, he adds. But the delights of the islands are goods of first intent, whose enjoyment needs no explanation or excuse. People crave them for what they are and actually need them more than all the amenities. He felt goods of first intent fit the purpose of creation revealed to Joseph Smith in the Doctrine and Covenants. We read, "All things which come to earth are made for the benefit and use of man, both to please the eye and to gladden the heart, for taste and for smell, to strengthen the body and to enliven the soul." Now, to Aristotle's dichotomy of goods, Nibley added a third: goods of third intent. These he defined as the one and only things which are not good in themselves and not useful of itself, but is prized above all else. It is money and the environment-wrecking practices that pursue it. He identified Geneva Steel and its pollution-belching mill as an example of a third intent good, as well as the nuclear waste dump in Beatty, Nevada, the slash harvesting 1,000-year-old redwood forest by Pacific Lumber Company, the strip mining of the sacred Blue Canyon, and the slaughter of whales for soap and shoe polish as examples of goods in third intent. The Doctrine and Covenants expressed well for Nibley the struggle between the pursuit of mammon and our stewardship over the earth. Therein he summarized, we are told that one, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the air and that which cometh of the earth is ordained for the use of man, for food and for raiment, and that he might have in abundance. But two, woe be unto the man that sheddeth blood or that wasteth flesh and hath no need. We may not take more than we need. For three, above all, we may not use this substance to exercise control and dominion over each other. But it is not given, the Doctrine and Covenants says, that one man should possess that which is above another. Wherefore, the world lieth in sin. This sweeping indictment against the whole world gets down to fundamentals. Before the blighting influences of inordinate appetite and the love of this world, the strength, power, beauty, and glory that once adorned the form and constitution of man have vanished away, Nibley lamented. Zion has ever been supplanted by Babylon, which is ever bent on converting the treasures of God's world into the substance of an idol, which waxes old and shall perish in Babylon, even Babylon the Great, which shall fall. While with Zion, the earth is to be renewed and receive its paradisical glory. Nibley invited all those who wish to pursue temporal wealth at the expense of environmental health to consider Moroni's ominous warning. For behold, ye do love money, O ye pollutions, who sell yourselves for that which will canker. Why have you polluted the holy church of God? Why do you build up your secret abominations to get gain and cause that widows should mourn before the Lord, and also orphans, and also the blood of their fathers and their husbands to cry unto the Lord? For vengeance is upon your heads. Behold, the sword of vengeance hangeth over you, and the time soon cometh that he avengeth the blood of saints upon you, for he will not suffer their cries any longer. And so Nibley concludes, we should never sacrifice environmental health for temporal wealth. Now, in conclusion, let me say that while we may not all agree with Nibley's environmental perspectives, we can agree that he was very clear about where he stood in regard to humanity's stewardship over creation. His passionate reasoning and his fervent writings on the topic invite each of us to consider several very important questions. What does it really mean to have dominion over the earth? How does God want me to care for creation? What is the relationship between spiritual and environmental health? How should and can nature and humanity cooperate? Can humanity progress without compromising or destroying natural resources? What is the proper balance between financial prosperity and environmental welfare? I believe we're indebted to our brother, the good Professor Nibley, not only for raising these important questions, but perhaps even more, for providing his well-reasoned perspectives to inform our contemplations, our conclusions, and our actions. Thank you.